No survivors after a mid-air crash in Washington, D.C.
Surveillance video shows the moment of collision between an American Airlines flight from Wichita, Kansas to Washington and a U.S. military helicopter that happened about 9 p.m. Wednesday.
Trump readies tariffs for Canada and Mexico.
President Donald Trump says the U.S. is being treated unfairly by its international partners, and he is ready to use the full force of the nation's economic power to change that.
And a prototype headset that adds scent to a virtual racing game.
It smells like a car crash, like burning tires.
Today is Friday, January 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strope. We begin tonight with tragedy near Washington, D.C., where all passengers are feared dead after an American Airlines jet carrying 60 passengers and four crew members and a U.S. Army helicopter with three soldiers on board collided mid-air late Wednesday. While officials investigate the exact cause, President Donald Trump, without evidence, suggested government diversity hiring programs as a possible reason for the crash near Reagan Washington National Airport. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wadukuswara has the story.
Emergency personnel, including divers, worked through the night in the frigid water of the Potomac River near the Reagan Washington National Airport where the wreckage fell. Surveillance video shows the moment of collision between an American Airlines flight from Wichita, Kansas to Washington and a U.S. military helicopter that happened about 9 p.m. Wednesday. 60 passengers and four crew members were on the plane, three soldiers aboard the helicopter. President Donald Trump offered condolences and speculated on the cause of the crash in remarks to White House reporters Thursday.
We do not know what led to this crash, but we have some very strong opinions and ideas.
Trump blamed diversity policies in the Federal Aviation Administration under his predecessors Barack Obama and Joe Biden.
A group within the FAA, another story, determined that the workforce was too white, that they had concerted efforts to get the administration to change that and to change it immediately.
He said the collision should have been prevented. Shortly before the crash, an air traffic controller asked the helicopter if it could see the plane. Officials say dozens of bodies have been pulled from the icy water. The crash is the first major crisis for Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, who was just sworn in Wednesday.
We are going to take responsibility at the Department of Transportation and the FAA to make sure we have the reforms that have been dictated by President Trump.
And for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who said the soldiers were on a training flight and wearing night vision goggles when the crash happened.
The military does dangerous things. It does routine things on the regular basis. Tragically, last night, a mistake was made.
American Airlines CEO Robert Isom vowed to assist in the investigation.
We are actively working with local, state, and federal authorities on emergency response efforts, and the American Airlines care team has been activated to assist our passengers and their families.
U.S. figure skating athletes, coaches, and family members were among the passengers, as were Russian world champion couple Evgenia Shishkova and Vadim Naumov. Spokesman for Russian President Vladimir Putin, Dmitry Peskov.
We offer our condolences to loved ones who lost our fellow citizens who died in this air crash. There are yet no plans on contact at the highest level.
The crash is the deadliest air disaster in the United States since November of 2001. Patsy Wadukuswara, VOA News at the White House.
For more on President Trump's response to the air disaster, I spoke with VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell. So the NTSB, the FAA, and many other agencies are going to be involved in the investigation into the crash. Now, none, as of this taping, have offered any conclusions as to the cause or the causes of the crash. President Trump, however, suggested that DEI programs at the FAA may be at least partially to blame. Has the president or anyone in his cabinet offered any evidence that DEI programs played a role in the incident?
No, Alexis. And in fact, this question was asked to him by one of the elder statesman journalists in the room of the New York Times, this precise question. And the president said, well, I have opinions and I have, quote, common sense. When President Trump speaks of common sense, he's speaking of a pillar of his policy that focuses on what he would call de-wokeifying or eliminating diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, requiring people to only use one of two genders to describe themselves, things like that. So this is part of a greater campaign and part of a belief set that the president clearly feels very strongly, although just to reiterate, he offered no evidence.
Has the Trump administration announced any steps that it will take at the FAA since there is the suggestion that DEI programs played a role?
Indeed. This afternoon, the president signed an order basically ordering the Secretary of Transportation. This is, of course, Sean Duffy, who's brand new in the job, just got there, I believe, yesterday, to examine all hirings in the last 4 years for safety and national security concerns. So it's not exactly clear what he's asking them to do, but he wants basically these agencies to go through their ranks and to look at who does not meet the, quote, qualifications to do the job.
And lastly, does the president have any plans to visit the crash site or meet with the families of the victims?
So the president was also asked this question as he was signing this order in the Oval Office this afternoon. And his response was that, indeed, yes, he has a plan to visit, but not the site. And then he said, and I'll just read you the quote, "The water? You want me to go swimming?" So a little bit of levity there in this very, very difficult time for all of those families, because as we understand, there are no survivors.
VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Now over to the Middle East, where Hamas freed 3 Israeli and 5 Thai hostages held in Gaza on Thursday, and Israel began releasing 110 Palestinian prisoners after delaying the process in anger at the surging crowds at one of the hostage handover points. Lucy Fielder has more.
Chaotic scenes as Hamas handed over Israeli hostage Abel Yehud to the Red Cross on Thursday, fearful and apparently struggling to walk as crowds surged around her. Israel delayed the release of 110 Palestinian prisoners under the Gaza ceasefire deal in an angry response, but went ahead after mediators committed to ensuring the safe passage of hostages in future releases, the Prime Minister's office said. An Israeli hostage abducted by Hamas from the same kibbutz as Yehud, 80-year-old Gadi Moses, was also released, along with 5 Thai nationals who'd been working on Israeli farms when armed militants burst through the border fence on October 7, 2023. And Israeli soldier Agam Berger, who was first led between ruined buildings and over piles of rubble in Jabalia in northern Gaza. Thursday's releases saw another show of force for Hamas, a reminder that it still has a strong presence in Gaza after more than 15 months of heavy bombardment from the Middle East's most advanced military. Yehud was handed over on the site of the bombed house of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, who was killed by Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu threatened death to anyone hurting hostages and urged mediators to ensure the jostling crowd scenes wouldn't be repeated. Later on Thursday, buses arrived in the West Bank city of Ramallah carrying some of the Palestinian prisoners, expected to be freed as part of the phased agreement. Palestinian health officials said at least 14 Palestinians were hurt by Israeli fire, some with live and rubber bullets, others from gas inhalation, as they gathered at the entrance to Ramallah in the Israeli-occupied West Bank to welcome the freed detainees. There was no immediate comment from Israel. In Israel, it was a day of celebration in what has become known as Hostages Square in Tel Aviv, where people were watching on giant screens. Some cheered when U.S. Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff joined them, in apparent gratitude for his role in securing the ceasefire deal. More than 250 hostages were abducted in the Hamas attack in Israel, and more than 1,200 people were killed, according to Israeli tallies. Israel's assault has killed more than 47,000 Palestinians in Gaza and laid waste to the enclave, where people face severe shortages of medicine, fuel, and food.
That was Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder. And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Israel has formally banned the main United Nations aid agency for Palestinian refugees, known as UNRWA, from operating on its territory, despite heavy diplomatic backlash. Humanitarian officials have warned that the move, which went into effect at midnight Thursday, could have a disastrous impact on aid delivery and jeopardize regional stability in the long term. As the ban on UNRWA in Israel came into effect, UN spokesperson for the Secretary General, Stephane Dujarric, said on Thursday the relief agency is continuing to deliver assistance and services in the Gaza Strip, West Bank, and East Jerusalem. Panama President José Raúl Mulino says there will be no negotiation with the United States over ownership of the Panama Canal. He also says that he hopes U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio's upcoming visit will allow them to focus on shared interests, like migration and combating drug trafficking. Being the destination for the first overseas visit by the top U.S. diplomat would have been big for Panama in any case, but Rubio comes as the emissary of U.S. President Donald Trump, who has repeatedly suggested the U.S. retake ownership of the Panama Canal. France has handed over its last military base in Chad to local authorities. The move on Thursday came 2 months after the former French colony in Central Africa broke off its defense cooperation agreement with Paris. Chad's army said that the French military handed over the air base in the Chadian capital, N'Djamena, to local authorities. Chad has been a key counterterrorism force in the region and was one of the last countries in which France maintained a large military presence. French forces have been ousted in recent years by Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso following years of fighting Islamic extremists alongside regional troops. The French army had around 1,000 personnel in Chad. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope. President Trump is widely expected to impose tariffs on goods from Mexico and Canada as early as February 1st as part of a plan he says will boost the U.S. economy. But with much about the specifics still unknown, economists, business owners, and everyday consumers are still trying to understand how it could impact them. Johnny Fernandez reports from New York City.
President Donald Trump says the U.S. is being treated unfairly by its international partners, and he is ready to use the full force of the nation's economic power to change that.
Tariffs will make our country rich.
The president threatened hefty levies against any nation that refuses his demands, whether they be combating illegal immigration and drug trafficking or decreasing U.S. trade imbalances. Economists have mixed feelings about how tariffs could impact the U.S. economy and consumers. James Galbraith is an American economist and a professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin.
A tariff strategy can be implemented in such a way that the cost largely falls outside the country.
Economist James Galbraith says Trump's tariffs could help bring back jobs to U.S. industries by making foreign goods more expensive. The goal is to reduce reliance on imports and strengthen domestic manufacturing. But some economists argue that tariffs diminish the economy's potential. Edmund Barisha is an associate professor of economics at Montclair State University in New Jersey.
In the long run, tariffs will produce more uncertainty. From the business point of view, no business owner wants to invest in a country that might face tariffs now or in the future.
On his first day in office, Trump said he was thinking about imposing a 25% tariff on goods from Mexico and Canada starting February 1st. This past weekend, he also threatened and then backed off from imposing similar tariffs on Colombia. Critics warned that such tariffs will have an immediate impact on American families and business owners. They say the cost of tariffs on everyday items like groceries, clothing, and coffee would get passed on to consumers.
We've been growing coffee in Colombia now for about 150 years, 160. We've had our farm and our family now for close to 80 years.
Jonathan Etreveri, owner of Paper Plane Coffee Company just outside of New York City, worries that if tariffs are imposed on Colombian goods, as Trump recently threatened, he will be forced to pass the higher costs on to customers.
Right now, we're actually in a bit of a coffee crisis where the price of commodity coffee is at the highest it's been in 50 years. So adding on top of that, a 25% potential tariff or even a 50% potential tariff will just exacerbate things.
Tariff advocates say it's not always the consumer who picks up the tab. James Galbraith is an American economist and a professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin.
That may well be the case, but not necessarily always. I have to ask how the foreign suppliers are going to react. And in some circumstances, they may react by cutting their profit margins and trying to maintain their market share.
As the threat of tariffs on Mexico and Canada looms, Americans are bracing for the possible impact on their jobs, businesses, and prices they pay. Johnny Fernandez, VOA News, New York.
Azerbaijan and Turkey are stepping up efforts to secure a land corridor between their countries through Armenia. Until now, Iran, a key ally of Armenia, has backed Yerevan's opposition to what is known as the Zengzur Corridor. With Iran weakened in the region, Ankara and Baku see an opportunity to secure a key strategic goal. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Ankara and Baku are stepping up efforts to create a land bridge known as the Zengezur Corridor between Azerbaijan and the autonomous region of Nakhchivan, which borders Turkey. Armenia opposes the corridor on its territory, but with its strategic partner Iran now weakened after setbacks in Syria and Lebanon, Azerbaijan and Turkey see an opportunity. Attila Yeşilada is a Turkey analyst for Global Source Partners.
The only reason why Armenia resists the establishment of the Zengezur or Zengzigur corridor is because of promises by Iran to militarily defend it. And Iran, coming under quote-unquote maximum pressure by the Trump administration, I don't think Azerbaijan or Turkey will take its threat seriously.
Iran strongly opposes the proposed 40-kilometer corridor because it would cut a vital route it uses to circumvent sanctions. But analysts say Iran's regional setbacks and the threat of increased pressure from Washington have left Tehran looking for friends in the region. Hussein Barja is a professor of international relations at Ankara's Middle East Technical University.
Making projection for the future, it would be good for Iran if the Zengezur corridor is opened. Then he has much better and closer relations with Turkey and Azerbaijan.
U.S.-Armenian joint military exercises last year were a sign of the close relationship between Yerevan and Washington, something analysts say has until now contained Turkey and Azerbaijan's intentions. But the new Trump administration has not yet indicated how it views the corridor project, and Yerevan is concerned that Baku and Ankara could try to exploit the uncertainty. Eric Hajupian, political consultant in Armenia.
Chaos is an opportunity for bad actors to do things that they normally wouldn't do. When there's no one on the watch.
In 2023, Azerbaijan's army, supported by Turkey, defeated Armenian-backed forces in the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. While Turkey would benefit economically from the Zengezur corridor, it could gain more diplomatically with Washington if it instead focuses on restarting the Azerbaijan-Armenia peace talks. Asla Aydintashbaş is an analyst with the Brookings Institution in Washington.
If Turkey can position that as something it supports, and that it would be very interesting to President Trump, who wants to position himself as an international peacemaker.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan wants close ties with U.S. President Donald Trump. At the same time, though, the Turkish leader is committed to supporting his Azerbaijani counterpart, Ilham Aliyev, in their shared goal of turning their countries into a land bridge between Europe and China. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
A small Chinese company sent shockwaves around the tech world this week with news that it had created a high-performing artificial intelligence system with less computing power and at a lower cost than ones made by U.S. tech giants. Michelle Quinn reports.
Up to this point, U.S. technology giants have led the global race to build the most advanced artificial intelligence systems. They rely on giant data centers and cutting-edge microchips. And they say they need more money to pay for more energy and more powerful chips. Now comes DeepSeek. The Chinese upstart has created an AI system that matches the performance of ones made in the United States. But DeepSeek says, compared to its American peers, it spent far less money
and used less computing power to manufacture its system. The news hit like a bomb across Silicon Valley. DeepSeek's app shot to number one in the Apple App Store. Stock prices of U.S. tech firms dropped. And Washington, which sees the U.S. in a fierce artificial intelligence race with China, took note.
The release of DeepSeek AI from a Chinese company should be a wake-up call for our industries that we need to be laser-focused on competing to win.
The U.S. has instituted stiff export controls to stop the highest-level chips from making it into China. DeepSeek claims that working within constraints helped it come up with cheaper workarounds, says Olaf Groth at the University of California, Berkeley, Haas School of Business. He spoke to VOA over Zoom.
It is low-cost, frugal innovation that is much faster and much less expensive to use, to both create and use, right? So as such, it will have appeal to a very broad swath.
DeepSeek's breakthrough sent a shudder in Silicon Valley in another respect. It relies on open source technology, which is shared and built upon by coders across firms and countries. That's a different approach from most AI giants, such as OpenAI, Microsoft, and Google, which keep their work under wraps. But 2 years ago, Meta, the parent of Facebook, released the code for Llama, its cutting-edge AI technology, so that others could use it to innovate. DeepSeek used Llama to teach its AI models and then released its technology to the open source community. Olaf Groth.
The open source community feels very strongly that open source is a very necessary way to go, because it democratizes, as it were, the both creation and use of artificial intelligence at lower cost.
Some observers say the advent of DeepSeek calls into question the effectiveness of the United States' recent AI policy. President Donald Trump has said he will make AI a priority. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
And finally, video games engage our senses of sight, hearing, and touch. Now our noses may be able to get in on the action. Researchers at the University of Warwick are using a prototype headset to investigate the use of olfactory stimuli in a virtual racing game, allowing players to smell the burning rubber of car tires. The headset's makers say its applications reach beyond the virtual world and could potentially be an early screener for Alzheimer's. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino reports.
It smells like a car crash, like burning tires.
PhD student Danelle Jojanova isn't in a vehicle. She's playing a video game. The smell she's describing is coming from a scent tube on the gaming headset she's wearing. It's a prototype for a novel experiment at the intersection of gaming and sensory science, looking at the use of olfactory stimuli in a virtual racing scenario, and whether it could give users a boost. Professor Alan Chalmers at the University of Warwick, which is celebrating its 60th anniversary, is leading the research.
Gaming, of course, people want a more immersive gaming experience, and of course smell is a very important part of the real world. So in the driving simulation that we're doing here, if you have the smell of the burning brakes, of course it's going to indicate there's a problem and you should maybe take your foot off the brake. So if you didn't have that smell of burning in the game, you wouldn't respond correctly.
The headset was designed to release specific odors such as machine oil and burning rubber at critical moments in the game. But Chalmers acknowledges those aren't exactly winning smells inside your home.
Smell-o-vision and scratch and sniff have been around for a long time, but the big problem with any smell is if you puff smell into an environment, how do you get rid of it? So really the research element is trying to deliver just the right amount of smell that you have the immersive experience without completely smothering the whole environment in it.
The project is a collaboration with video game developers Hollywood Gaming. They're aiming to create the next big thing in gaming, though the research has applications beyond the game console. Chalmers and his team have also developed a prototype device that tests people's sense of taste. He says it could be used as an early screening tool for Alzheimer's disease by measuring how someone's sense of smell and taste changes over time in, say, a cooking game.
We can check how good you are compared to your age, your sexual ethnicity, or compared to yourself 6 months ago. If you're not where you should be, then you could have a problem and you should be looked at further.
That was Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino reporting for us. And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe. Thanks for listening.